This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Hello, Australia. Welcome to My Millennial Money. Jumping in here for a special little update midweek. And I'm joined by Alex Vikovich from the Australian Financial Review, or the AFR. Alex, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
G'day, Glenn. Thanks for having me, mate. Last time you had me on here, I'm pretty sure I told your listeners that Donald Trump was about to be re-elected as President of the United States. So I'm glad that you had me back once again, man, so I can spread some more misinformation.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you might be right when it comes around to next election. So,
That's true. Yeah. I don't think I was quite as sure as I'm making it out now. I'm sure there were some nuances and caveats in there.
Yeah, and there's actually always nuances in everything, isn't there? And this is, I think, why I like to do these podcasts and maybe just have a bit more of an open form chat about a topic rather than just seeing a paragraph of text online.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So we're going to talk about a couple of things today, and they're realistically just articles that I've seen that Alex has written on the AFR and topics that he's written about and I want to discuss. The first one, we're going to talk about the super changes that have come in, and then we might have a quick break and then swing back around and talk about this Finfluencer business. Now, I will say a couple of things at the outset. Alex is a... You know, I think you're a good journalist, Alex.
Thanks, Glenn. I think you're a great podcaster, mate.
Thanks. Well, I was going to say, I think you're a great journalist, but, you know, there's always room to move. But I do want to say, like, you know, Alex is a journalist, and I know that, you know, I've known Alex for some time. He's been a writer in the wealth space for some time as well. We carry on like friends and all that stuff, but I'm under no illusion. If I mess up, he's going to come out and get me because you're a journalist and you're just after the facts and the truth. So I just want to say that, Alex, like I know that I'm patting a tiger when I talk to you on and off the records.
Well, you know, no friends but also no enemies. That's kind of how it goes.
Yeah, that's right.
So try and keep it fair with everyone.
That's right. So the super changes that have recently got up, can you talk to us about maybe some of the politics behind it first, and then we'll list some of the changes that are actually now in law?
Yeah, sure. So it's been a bit of a difficult birth, this one, for the Morrison government. And if people haven't been paying attention, then frankly, I'm not super surprised, since it's, you know, fair to say it's not the most important thing or the most pressing thing probably on the national agenda over the last year. But certainly, you know, a topic that is very important, not just to people's financial lives, but to both sides of politics. And what we saw, you know, heading into the budget last year, remember the federal budget was kicked down the road because of the pandemic. So come October, they called us all in here as they usually do, although we don't head to Canberra anymore for the lockup. You know, it's all, we've all got our separate lockups, which we did in the AFR newsroom, and the Treasury pointy heads come and take your phone off you, and they let you into the lockup to get access to the budget documents. And you've got about 5 hours to sort of pour over to those and put together the next day's paper, which is a sort of great tradition, in the media and one that goes back a long way. And before I went in, you know, I called a few contacts in the superannuation industry, people that run big funds and some of the lobbyists and so on. And I said, so, you know, what are you guys expecting? We're not hearing much, but what do you, you know, what's going to be in there? And they all said, oh, not this year. You know, we've had enough fights in the past. There's not going to be anything, no nasty surprises this year. It's all going to be pandemic front to back. So I was pretty surprised when I got in there, and it was my job to cover super for us. There was quite a lot to cover, and a serious piece of legislative reform that was, you know, in their language, going to shake up the industry. And the goal of it primarily was to try and return about $18 billion worth of fees back to consumers over the next decade. Now, we know that there is a lot of inertia in the system. This is something that the Productivity Commission looked at a few years ago. You know, the problem is that a lot of members, you know, because it's compulsory, a lot of members are just not engaged. And even though a lot of super funds have been providing a pretty decent service, and some of them are, you know, not for profit in the way that they run, they have been charging arguably exorbitant fees. We pay $30 billion in fees in 2019, which is, you know, almost as much as we used to spend overseas before the pandemic. So look, it's serious amounts of money. The rivers of gold, people who follow superannuation closely call it, and it's rivers of gold because people largely have not opted in. They don't see that money. But of course, what's changed is a few things, and one of them is the early release scheme, which no doubt you've touched on before, Glenn. And I think this was a way that the government was really kind trying to test whether people really did feel that super is still the sacred cow that it used to be, or whether a new generation might be more willing to dip into super and might see it as their own money. And you know, that's been super controversial. But that's important kind of background, was the early release scheme, because sources in the government are sort of saying to us they feel like they won that argument, even though they were smashed in TV ads. And, you know, a lot of people were against it. The industry was, you know, came out really strongly against it. But I think the government feels as though it has achieved the goal of connecting at least part of a new generation with the idea that super is real money. And that's pretty powerful if that is the case. And so there's all sorts of fights to come down the road that we can talk about another time, super for housing and so on. But the idea was this reform package would aim at reducing fees, and it would do that a number of ways. It would subject super funds to a new annual performance test. Now, the way in which that they were going to go about that was super controversial, just like everything relating to superannuation. But they ended up changing that a couple of times. But there's a sort of a methodology there by which funds will be tested on their performance every year, net of fees. And if they twice flunk that test, basically they'll be put out of business. In the first instance, they need to write to members to let them know that they've flunked. There's an online ranking tool, which, you know, during the whole political argy-bargy over the last year, probably hasn't been the one that's been focused on the most. But now that it is law of the land, or will be law of the land, it's probably going to be one of the most important, particularly for younger people, because the idea is, you know, people can go online, it's administered by the ATO, and they can essentially see how their fund is performing relative to others. Now, this is a pretty normal thing, right, that we have on the internet now. You know, Finder and Canstar and all these really pretty successful comparison tools have gone and done this in asset classes and in products like insurance, for example. But one of the things that's been missing from their arsenal, of course, is super funds. Why? Because it is a nightmare, right? Whatever methodology you choose, you're going to face seriously well organized and capitalized political operatives, and they're going to come at you hard because there's a lot of money at stake, right? Mm-hmm. It is a system. And so I think it's important for people. I'll go back and continue to explain, you know, whatever else was in this package, and we can go into them in some detail. But sure. I think it's important when you're talking about super to understand for both sides of politics how important this is. On the one side, you've got the Labor Party that considers it almost like Medicare. You know, this is Paul Keating's great legacy, the compulsory superannuation system. For them, it's a total sacred cow. And it stands for what they believe in, which is a sort of, you know, a strong role for government, in sort of, ameliorating inequality by making sure that it's not only people who are, you know, perhaps have high levels of financial literacy or high levels of income who are saving for their retirement, but all workers mandated by the state, right? And then on the other side, you know, you've got the Liberal Party, many of whom, you know, their rank and file have always been opposed to this concept on purely philosophical grounds, because it's, you know, a compulsory sort of annexing of people's own money against their will, which is super, you know, non-libertarian kind of thoughts. But over the years, the Liberal Party, just like they did with Medicare, I think has come to realize that they've kind of lost that argument, and, you know, it has broad public support, the compulsory nature of the system. But what they've done instead of trying to completely you know, undermine it or make it voluntary is try to tinker with it to make it more competitive, to make it more efficient. And so what that means is they essentially want to try and get as best as possible a bit of a free market happening, which is always really difficult to do when you're dealing with a compulsory product, that people haven't opted into, haven't signed up to. And of course, you know, the bulk of it is really determined by, not people's choice on the open market, but the particular agreements that their employer, that their workplace has in place by way of the default system. So, you know, if you're in a particular industry, then there's a union who has worked very hard to get a workplace agreement that directs funds to a particular fund, right? And all those things are big money spinners from the industry. And I suppose that's the other political element here that a lot of conservatives and libertarians really don't like about the superannuation system, is that, you know, trade unions are a lot less powerful than they used to be because the industries that they represent by and large have been disrupted by technology and, you know, their membership is declining. But at the same time, the industry super funds, which is the one that everyone, the ones everyone will recognize from, you know, the big TV ads, the compare the pair ads and the fox and the hen house, they are, at least historically, linked to the trade union movement. So even though union membership is declining, industry super funds, particularly since the Royal Commission, which, you know, really portrayed bank-owned funds in a really bad light, while industry funds were kind of left unscathed at the end of that banking Royal Commission. Since then, they've boomed. You know, they're at $800 billion. They're up 30% in a few years. So they're really booming, which a lot of advocates for industry funds and for non-profit super would say is a great thing, that you've sort of taken all these people out of bank-owned funds that were underperforming and put them in industry super funds. But the politics of that also means that the trade unions and by extension the Labor Party have a huge donor base that was previously closed to them, right? So that's the kind of realpolitics here. You know, the nature of any compulsory system is always going to be politically charged, right? When I talk to Americans about, for example, the Australian super system, they'll just, you know, their minds are blown that both sides of politics and our entire super system and our entire political system supports a policy that sort of is government mandated savings, right? But then you talk to people in Europe and they're jealous of the efficiency and size of Australia's pension system, which is, you know, envy of the world and all that. So, you know, there's really macro themes that tie in to super that make it really politically charged. And the bit that's even more annoying is that both sides of the debate with super tend to not want to admit that they're coming from an ideological or a political position. So the way that I'm talking with you right now, you'll generally only hear a financial journalist speak that way.
Yeah.
Anyone else who has a dog in this fight around super will tell you the other side are completely ideological and our side is based on facts. And our economists are better than their economists. And it's just a bit of a nightmare for consumers because no one is willing to say, you know, these are my stripes. I am a dyed-in-the-wool supporter of, you know, the labor movement, and that's why I think industry funds should be as powerful as possible. Or on the flip side, you know, I don't really believe that trade unions should have a role in capital markets and therefore I, you know, want to try and get industry funds and make them less powerful. Like nobody really who's in the fight will speak that honestly about it. And so they, you know, go to these great lengths to, you know, put in different assumptions and pump out different answers and there's all these kind of alternative facts that fly around in terms of the numbers and how much worse off a worker's going to be if this law comes in or that law comes in. So that's why it's both an interesting and a fraught space to write about for those who do my job.
It's funny. I, as you know, like I've just finished this book and in the super chapter and the investment chapter, I actually spent a lot of time researching under the hood of a lot of funds and it's actually so bloody confusing. I pretty much resolved that the compare the pair campaign was a joke because I couldn't even compare the same industry funds with each other because of the asset allocations. It's horrendous. But
and all those problems that you've come up with, I mean, they're still going to be problems when this online ranking tool gets off the ground.
And
in fact, it'll be only bigger problems.
So just to bring it back, so we've got the online ranking. We've got the if you've
super the online ranking, the performance tool.
Yep,
the performance test,
which is basically we think that it's going to be what like we're going to every year the last 6 years of returns.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And basically, they just apply the certain benchmarks based on so they're index based, right? So they're sort of comparing to the market in the relevant asset class. There was a bit of a whole scandal last year. When a lot of the kind of, finance nerds who were looking at the policy as it was, sort of explained in the budget, and they said, look, what's going to happen here is that, there's going to be an incentive for super funds to just follow the index. Now, a lot of super products out there do just do that, right? Mm-hmm. And they get, people like Vanguard or BlackRock, big global, index hugging sort of mm-hmm. managers, to do that. And that's not an illegitimate thing, I think, as long as, consumers know that's what they're getting. And frankly, they should be paying less for that. So the disclosure around the fact that that's what a lot of funds are doing, is not well disclosed. But I think, but there's a lot of bigger funds though who don't do that and who do their own investment management or outsource to active fund managers and the big industry super funds, you know, Australian Super, Cbus, Host Plus, these you know massive mega not for profit funds that are linked to trade unions historically. One thing that they've always prided themselves on as well is sort of a nation building role, right? Yeah. So you'll see that on the telly. You'll get a former Labor MP or minister like Greg Combe, and he'll come on and talk to you about how important the industry funds, the role that they've played in sort of supporting the nation's infrastructure. So what they actually mean there is that they're actually deploying member money to unlisted infrastructure, property and construction projects, which on the whole have been relatively, lucrative for them. And so a lot of the funds themselves, but also the kind of academics in this space, and lobbyists and so on were nervous that there would be this because they were index-based benchmarks that there would be this incentive for funds to just go, well, screw it, we're not going to bother doing that. We're just going to, sign people up to a Vanguard index fund the way that a lot of people are playing along at home. And then what, the losers of that would be, these massive nation building projects and airports and roads and, things that are sort of politically popular and important for the country as well. And, then it wasn't just the industry that had to go at the government. They were sort of pretty well equipped to deal with that. They're pretty used to taking on the super lobby, particularly the industry fund. But then it was the Nationals as well who turned around and they said, well, hang on, if this is the case, then we don't really like this either, because of course a lot of those super rivers of gold go to regional projects that employ a lot of people in regional and rural areas, and so the government backed down on that. And they added another couple of indices, one for property and one for infrastructure.
Yep.
And that seems to have sort of fixed the problem. So it's a technical fight, but one that's important for people to understand, because the sort of the consensus is that that whole sort of scare campaign last year, super funds will no longer invest in infrastructure. All they'll do is, sign you up to an index fund, so you're better off doing it yourself, which was a lot of the commentary that was out there, and that had some merit at the time. That seems to have gone away, and it doesn't seem to be the consensus. So that's the performance test.
And then if they don't meet the performance test, they've got to let their members know, and then if they don't meet it for a second year, they're not allowed to take new members into their My Super option.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, that's already fraught with danger, right? I mean, if people opening letters from super funds was an effective way of creating an efficient superannuation market, we would have had that a long time ago. All of us are getting letters from our super fund all the time, right? But it hasn't moved the needle on engagement at all. So look, the performance test, I think, will be one that is really more for regulators and for the industry itself to take note of. It's really the online ranking tool that's more consumer-facing.
Yeah, but I think the whole thing sucks because, and sure, it's better than nothing, but I'm skeptical for a couple of reasons, and this is just off the back of me researching how the super funds work for the book. Like, there is so much smoke and mirrors behind the scenes with super funds. Like, it's so crazy. And I'm thinking, oh, well, do they maybe withhold an unlisted asset price until after the date, or bring it forward, the valuation, and massage for numbers? Like, that's number one. But number two, we don't want people every 10 minutes looking at this and changing funds every year.
That's totally right. And it's not just confusing, right, Glenn? Like, there's a dark arts at play here. Like, it's opaque on purpose.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. If people don't understand it, and this is the way that the financial services industry, I would say, traditionally has operated, right? The more complexity in the system, the more difficult it is to understand, the more likely it is that you're going to pay a higher fee for somebody else to deal with it. Right. And that's the democratization that we've seen. But having said that, I do think you're right. You know, there are those problems, but I also don't think, you know, that it's fine to say, well, you know, certain funds are just going to game the system. So better to just not have a tool at all, which is what we've had.
Yeah. I think it's good in principle, but I've just got a healthy level of skepticism.
100%.
Just in the way that funds can disclose their asset allocation. And I'll give you an example, one that I looked at in the book as a pre-thing, and this isn't a sale about my book, but, you know, they say if you look at the risk levels that APRA set out, you've got 1 to 7, with 7 being high growth and I think over 6 years of negative returns, right? And I guess what I'm getting at is AustralianSuper's default fund, right? It's set at 80% growth for a balanced fund. Number one, don't know what planet you're on, but that's not balanced when it's 80% to growth. Number two, it behaves like a 90% growth fund. And they also say it's one of the only funds that say there's a minimum hold time suggested of 10 years. Now, we know that more risky and volatile assets, you want to hold for at least 7 to 8 to 9 years. But why have they got a fund that's at 80% growth and we're saying that we suggest you hold this for 10 years? And the skeptic in me thinks it's either a hold onto the fund longer, or they're doing something with the asset allocation behind the scenes that's actually more risky than, you know, saying we suggest you hold this for 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. And look, and that's, you know, these reforms that have come through last week and that are now law are just a small tip of the iceberg in terms of the you know, the range of debates that are out there. But one of them is around this point that you've raised of the kind of competing definitions. You know, one fund considers balance X, another one considers it Y. And look, I think skepticism is the right word. I mean, that's certainly the way that we look at it, as the media does with everything. I don't think it would be right to say that they're all out there trying to simply fleece, you know, their members for nefarious political purposes. And equally, I don't think it would be right to say that they're all out there, you know, because they're some have a not
no, but I guess I'm saying good actors, or like if AustralianSuper come out and say we're the highest performing fund in Australia. Well, that's fine, but if we can compare it to all the other funds, you know, it's actually...
Yeah, you have to have that overlay.
Like, you've just got to look at the asset allocation, and there's something going on, and I'd love AustralianSuper to be able to come on the podcast and actually explain it to me, because I'm genuinely...
You've got more chance than the Financial Review, let me tell you. But
well, but again, it might prove that they'll never want to work with me on a commercial basis, which is fine, but I've genuinely got some questions, and I couldn't find the answers online.
Yeah, look, it's not easy to find answers in this space. I've been trying to do it for a decade. And that's where, you know, I think the government pushing through with these reforms in the middle of a pandemic, even though there is huge lobbyist pushback, even though there are, you know, really well-heeled consultants who make a living out of telling, you know, showing funds how to game this sort of stuff, I do think that they deserve some credit for having a crack at it. But of course, there are going to be all sorts of problems. And one of the problems actually around what you're saying is one of the key criticisms of the performance test is that there isn't a risk overlay, right? So it's going to look at, you know, performance net of fees and essentially, you know, raw data on returns, but it's not going to factor in how much risk a fund took on in order to achieve that return.
Exactly.
And so you will get this kind of, you know, tail chasing element.
What do they call it, like the risk adjusted return?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah.
And so this is not that. Yeah, look, there are all of these problems that have been levelled against the policy, and you know that's fair. And of course, there were a lot of criticisms that were made that were effective because the government has changed this bill a number of times, you know, everyone got to have their say. Pauline Hanson was in there at the end negotiating, and it really was a kind of circus. And so you know, they've done an okay job of dealing with some of those concerns, but a lot of others remain.
Now, the other thing that's, I think, probably one of the biggest wins is the stapling of people's super fund. I know the Labor Party didn't like that, which I don't know why they actually generally didn't like that measure.
Yeah, well,
can you explain the measure and the politics behind it?
Yeah, it's complex because now you're getting closer to the default sort of system, which is the heart of the conflict, I would say, in superannuation, right? And so the way that it has traditionally worked is that, you know, most people, as we said, are pretty apathetic. They join one fund when they're having their first ever job. In, you know, the vast majority of cases at that stage in your working life, you're just going to be defaulted into whatever the default fund is that is associated with that employer. So it might be, you know, most likely it's one of the big industry funds that have a connection to the union.
Yeah, wasn't the, it was the Gillard government that put it in the award that if a person doesn't select a super fund, it goes into an industry fund. Like, it's in most awards.
Yeah, well, and that's something that the unions have fought very hard to get those into workplace agreements, right? Mm. Now they would say they're doing their members a great service because they're stopping them from going into retail funds that have you know, charged more and in recent years anyway underperformed. So you know that would be their argument, the way that it always is. To be fair, but the stapling measure, the idea is, you know, traditionally you would leave a job, then you'd be defaulted into another fund, then you'd be defaulted into another fund, which is that familiar circumstance that a lot of your listeners will understand, which is you're getting all these different letters from all these different groups, some of which are not even spelling your name right. And the big problem there, there's many, right, in terms of compounding interest and so on, but the main problem is that you're paying fees to all of them separately.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely
often paying insurance to all of them separately. And duplication is a serious problem in the industry that both sides of the warring sector admit is a problem. And so the government, this is one of the main ways, this stapling, that the government thinks that it can actually put money back in people's pockets in terms of the fees that are being taken out of the system. So instead, what they're going to do is staple the member to the first fund that they ever defaulted into. Mm. And then when you switch jobs, you'll stay with that fund. Now, that would be an effective way of going about duplication, but there's a few problems. What the industry super funds say is that the really big problem there is that because it is, you know, all funds that are eligible for this, all you have to do is have the default arrangement with the employer in order to get the business. They say that, you know, there's a high likelihood that many people will be stapled to an underperforming fund, which would be worse for them in the long run than having the duplication problem and going from fund to fund. Mm. The industry funds say that it would be around $230,000. You'd be $230,000 worse off if you're a sort of 20-year-old going into a dud fund than if you had just, you know, moved to another fund at 23, you know, 3 years later. But
any side of the fence can do projections and assumptions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so people do need to be skeptical about those. But nonetheless, I'm giving a sense of the sort of, you know, language that's out there and the ideas are out there because, of course, that's my job. So I think that, this measure here is a bit of a dent in the default super system because, you know, for a lot of funds out there, not the really big funds that have a lot of first-time full-time workers. So, you know, groups like Host Plus and Rest that have a lot of, you know, uni students and younger members, you know, they're going to still continue to benefit from this. But a lot of other industry super funds, so for example, HESTA, which represents the healthcare industry and nurses, or the construction industry fund, CBUS, you know, they tend to have slightly higher numbers of members who have had previous jobs because there's a, you know, there's education you need to go and receive before you enter the healthcare workforce, for example, you know. Or similarly, UniSuper or Legal Super, some of these more educated or specialised funds. So they're going to sort of struggle as a result of this because they have traditionally picked up a lot of business from the default system. I guess, you know, the government would say and supporters of this law would say that none of this matters anymore if the online ranking tool works
and
people use it.
Yeah.
That's right. And so, you know, the government's response to this is none of this stuff matters. We're actively trying to, you know, to put some dents in the default super system because we want a system that is basically consumer-led and where people are looking at the numbers and effectively choosing their own funds off the back of that.
But the problem is, you know, yeah, if I'm sounding skeptical about super funds, it's because I am, and I'm scared. Like, I would probably even say if you're in a super fund and it's in the top 10 on that list or the top 50 or whatever that is on the list, it's probably an okay fund. You don't have to shop every year because that list, you'll fall into the trap of knowing or believing that past performance is an indication of future performance.
Yeah, so yeah. That's right. If you're going off, you know, pure numbers and so look, I do think some of this, I do think the online ranking tool is helpful just to kind of get a sense, but you know, just like any other investment, I think you got to do a lot more due diligence than just going off a ranking. There's no perfect methodology and this is why it's important for people, I think, to understand this broader context and that, like, this political issue is never going away. You know, both sides of this debate are key donors and supporters of our two main political parties. And so this is going to continue to be an issue. That's why the other interesting element to this bill, just to round out the full package, the fourth element after stapling is this clarification that funds need to act in the best financial interests of their members. Now, some lawyers say that the previous rule, which was that they have to act in their best interests, already kind of factors in financial interests. But this is a sign of the government going hard to say that, you know, basically funds need to be focused on generating a financial return to their members and nothing else. Now, they haven't given a full answer of all the, you know, a full answer to all the theories flying around about why they might be keen to do that. But sources of mine in Treasury basically seem to say that they expect it will be more difficult for funds to do massive sponsorships of stadiums, to do TV advertising, and that they are indeed trying to crack down on that. Mm. The government's being a bit more careful in its language. It is saying that basically funds can do whatever they want, but every dollar that they spend, they'll need to justify, and they've reversed the onus of proof so that funds actually need to explain to the authorities why that dollar was in the financial interest of members. So that's going to take a lot of paperwork, and for a lot of smaller funds, they're just not going to bother.
Yeah, that's right. But also, like, if you look at the numbers, you would hope and think that what's good for the geese is good for the gander. And a fund might say, well, if we get more funds under management, we can run the business more efficiently and all that stuff. So
that's true. And that's the argument that's gone back for years here. You know, before the Banking Royal Commission, there was a lot of talk about the fact that industry funds and not just the bank-owned funds, were going to, you know, come out of this inquiry looking pretty bad. And that is because, you know, a lot of critics of industry funds, you know, do say that they are, because they're not for profits and they don't have to generate a shareholder return, they do spend, you know, inordinate amounts of money on TV advertising. And those TV ads have, to go to your point around past performance, have often trumpeted their past performance, right?
Mm.
But the industry funds were pretty effective at that inquiry of saying, well, no, every dollar we spend on TV advertising is in our members' interests because we're saving them from being in a crappy bank-owned fund that is there to generate a profit to the owners and to the shareholders. And, you know, the Royal Commission accepted that answer, and that's a pretty good ally to have for that case. So, you know, this is going to continue to be the line from industry funds. And frankly, there's you know, there are, I think, both sides to that argument. But what's going to be interesting is if a lot of funds are nervous to be engaging in marketing or education or financial literacy because they're scared that of how, you know, it will be perceived, or indeed they're scared of breaching this financial best interest duty, then that's one of their main arsenals traditionally for trying to explain things to people, right? So, yeah, pros and cons of that one. But I guess the general point with super is I would encourage your listeners to share your level of skepticism to try and engage with the media around this. You know, we get accused from time to time of being on one side or the other at our newspaper. But I would say most of the time both sides are pissed off at me. Which is generally a pretty good indication that you've got it right. So I would say, you know, be careful of the information sources because, you know, both sides of the superannuation system, as we said, are not just big donors to politics but to media. They do a lot of TV advertising. They sponsor the footy. You know, they are major contributors to our national public purse strings.
Well, even halfway through 2018, Sun Super was a show partner of my podcast for a year. And I would, you know, I would welcome any super fund if they wanted to be a show partner because I like money. I need money to make a living. And I will say, just for everyone that's listening and who knows about our podcast, and, you know, there are a couple of super funds that have reached out to me and I've said, no, I'm not comfortable with you being a sponsor on the show. One of the reasons I went with Sun Super was their level of transparency with the information they've got on their website, and it kind of met my gut test and all that stuff. But you know, I do like money like the next person. But
well, it's good that you're you know, you're so transparent about that, Glenn. But since you are spruiking your own sponsorship opportunities there, I should say any super funds are welcome to come on and sponsor the Wealth Generation newsletter at the Australian Financial Review as well, if they are listening. Not that I get paid to do any sales. I certainly don't get any commissions.
And we might actually use this as a segue to talk about this influencer stuff because it is around money. So we're going to take a quick break and we will be back right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click get help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click get help.
Okay, we're back. We were talking about money and sponsors and all that stuff. And I'll be the first to say I'm out here running a business online and I need to make money to pay the 5 staff in the business to provide a free podcast to everybody. That's all fine. The AFR, it's a commercial world. You guys need sponsors. You know, I think conflicts can be managed, Alex. And all that to say is... the influencers, what's happening? Because you bloody kicked a bee's hive a couple of weeks ago and then there was a story that went up this week. And if you are listening, the date is the 20... What's the date today, Alex? The 20...
Is the 22nd?
It's the 22nd, yes, because it's my
birthday. Is that the 22nd?
Yeah, it's my birthday in 2 days, everyone.
Happy birthday.
So we are recording this on the 22nd of June in the afternoon. An article went up yesterday, and I think it was today in print on the AFR, about Dobbin, a dodgy finfluencer to ASIC. Now, you kicked a freaking bee's nest a few times in your Wealth Generation newsletter, and we'll put a link in the show note if you want to subscribe to that, and some articles online around this finfluencer thing. Where are we at? what the hell's going on, and then I'll answer some questions that people have sent through as
I've
well.
I've not been kicking any bees' nests, Glenn James. I've just been fairly and accurately reporting the sectors that I'm tasked with. But look, it is a fascinating space, and this goes back a little way. You know, it was really the sort of August last year when the retail boom had kind of happened already. This is, you know, well before GameStop, but, you know, we were already starting to see this kind of influx to the markets. And ASIC actually pulled all of these stockbrokers and different sort of institutional players in for a webinar, and it said to them, and this is just around the same time that it sort of came out publicly confirming that the numbers of retail investors had gone through the roof in Australia, which a lot of people sort of suspected, but, you know, the numbers around that, it was just about to release. But it also pulled them together and it said, you know, we're concerned around herd mentality in the markets. And we think that that is partly to do with what it calls social trading, right? So the idea that people's investment decisions have by and large been directed or influenced by their peers on social media or by, you know, people who are more authoritative commentators on social media, which we now call influencers. And, of course, this space goes right back, right? You know, it's, you know, ASIC first put out its guidance around giving advice at what you can and can't say about investments in online forums, you know, more than 10 years ago now, maybe even close to 20 years ago. You know, it was very much a sort of post early internet kind of, you know, chat room style discussion. And it hasn't updated that, and clearly I think it needs to. But there has always been, you know, the hot coppers of the world and online forums dedicated to investors. And they've always, you know, straddled that kind of line between information and advice. I guess what has changed is firstly the profile of the investors. You know, ASIC is of the belief that there's a lot more inexperienced investors who are self-directed and who are putting in larger amounts of their own capital into the markets and are therefore perhaps slightly more vulnerable. But it also, you know, the internet itself has changed a lot. So one of the things that the regulator is grappling with is that it's a lot easier for them to go in and monitor a hot copper forum or than it is for them to monitor a live stream, for example, on Facebook or even TikTok, because, it, you know, these are like generally boomer or at least Gen X lawyers that we're talking about who don't really know how to use TikTok, right? Mm. So they've actually had to invest to look into this. And so that's the kind of macro view of what's going on, is that as we're seeing these larger numbers of really millennial and Gen X investors into the markets, we're also seeing more scrutiny of the, advice sources or information sources that they're using to invest. Now, all of that is stuff that your readers and listeners know, mate, because I suppose you were a bit of an early finfluencer, if I can call you that.
But whatever.
but they follow these individuals and they engage with this content. I think what's probably important to know, and you know, ASIC hasn't said this publicly, but this is sort of my understanding of how ASIC is thinking about this internally. I guess there's kind of two buckets when you look at the finfluencers. There are the ones who are effectively criminals, who are small in number but high risk, who are effectively using social media platforms in order to either, you know, raise money for pure scams, or they are pushing products in an illegal way or accepting illegal forms of remuneration. And so they're small in number, but that seems to be the main thing that ASIC and indeed the other regulators around the world are really focused on. And I think that's probably a good thing. That's where they should be mainly focusing, right, is trying to get rid of the sharks.
Hey, just before we move on to the non-sharks, I just sent you a screenshot of an influencer, and someone sent me this. And this person did a screenshot, and you can look at the profiles, a big following, A while back, I was doing custom portfolios for a select few people, and I want to do it again for 20 more people. I'll draw up a custom portfolio for you based on your investment size, risk appetite, and time frame. I'll write out what cryptos I personally would buy based on that criteria. And he goes on, and he's basically selling these for $1,000.
Gee, it's not cheap. $1,000. No. You can have an initial, consultation and some sort of scale plan with, any top financial planner in the country.
Yeah, bloody Life Sherpa for $500.
Exactly.
It's out there and it's real. And this guy here, he's blatantly giving personalized advice because he's taking into account objectives.
Yeah, that's right. So this is an example of exactly what ASIC's looking for, where most likely the person who's written this meme here knows what they're doing is illegal. They're most likely, they're not super sophisticated criminal, but they're basically scammers, right? Mm. And they're conducting an illegal activity. So look, if people see that stuff, ASIC is keen to hear about it. I'm keen to hear about it at the AFR. Whether people choose to dob in others is I guess a moral and ethical question.
Well, and the thing is, Alex, remember I was dobbed into ASIC.
Exactly right. And so there are people that are going to be caught up in this.
Yeah.
And look, ASIC would take the view that, if you say something, right? I mean, that's probably the safer way to be.
It was funny. For the newer listeners, someone dobbed me into ASIC and we went through a heap of phone calls and they went through all my podcasts and YouTube, and they actually, there was the case manager on the phone and the ASIC lawyer, and they said, Glenn, on this date, you uploaded this video and you said this statement here. And they asked me, do you think that was personal or general advice? Do you think that was factual information? Like, they were not messing around 100%.
Yeah. And I'm sure that was a pain in the ass for you, but I actually...
Oh, mate, I was scared. I was like, freaking, I called, Vince Scully. I called Vince. I'm like, am I going to jail? Like, we took the high road at My Millennial Money, and we now pay for a general advice license. Hey, I just want to jump in. I'm editing this myself, this episode, because it was done late in the day and Nath, our usual editor, finishes at 5. I just want to clarify that ASIC gave me some writing on letterhead that I wasn't in the wrong and I didn't do anything that effectively breached any laws that they could see. But that's why I did take the high ground just in case, because it was grey and I wanted to not work in the grey areas. So that's why I pay for a general advice license now, just for the avoidance of all doubt. Okay, back to the interview.
The other point that ASIC does make is that, it really does need to be generating an income out of this advice in order for it to be something that ASIC looks at quite clearly. But that doesn't mean that other regular people won't be caught up in this quite easily, because ASIC, sources of mine at ASIC have said to me that they are watching the other type of influencer as well, which is perfectly well-meaning people who are not criminals, who are the people that many of us follow for fun, who have genuinely good intentions and may either by simply making a mistake, put out misinformation or potentially false and misleading information that could, direct people's investment choices and cause problems for them.
Yeah. And I must say, a couple of years ago, I really wanted to make it my personal mission that we get Australia talking about personal finance the same way we talk about personal fitness and we're wearing activewear to the shops and all that. So I think there's a place for someone to say, hey, I've got this account. This is how I save money at the supermarket. This is how we went on holidays and there was, we did these hacks. That's such good encouragement. It's such good engagement. And I learn from some of these FinTocker accounts because, I can't cover everything. I don't know what it's like to run frugal because it's not my skill set. So it's a tough place.
It is a tough place. I guess I don't. I guess the reason why to go to your kicking down the bee's nest or whatever you accuse me of. I think you know the reason that I have been supportive. I'd say recently more than others in the media around some of these finfluencers. Partly because I think that in the case that you're talking about, you know, you had a couple of young women there with growing social media profiles who were simply you know criticizing a product. And then bring it to the attention of the press, which, you know, to explain my own biases, any journalist worth their salt would always support a whistleblower, and would come in to support them, and wouldn't have them be, you know, publicly bullied if they were helpful in terms of trying to provide information that may or may not be in the public interest, right? So this is a case where, you know, I think that the questions that are being asked, not just by these finfluencers, because I guess the definition of a finfluencer is once they cross over to actually monetizing and you know making a coin from it, but also their followers and regular people who are chiming in. The questions they're asking are the right questions, right? As a journo, like I think that they are doing a great service. Now, sometimes, of course, there's going to be inaccuracy out there, and fair enough, because nobody is paid by and large some sort of upfront fee, expecting that to be you know accurate And they're not under a licensing regime that requires them to be. I mean, I would encourage people to be as responsible in their online discourse as possible, right? But for me, the benefits, as you've just spoken about them, of engaging people in finance, asking questions of providers, helping to bring about that skepticism, all of that to me outweighs any potential downside from a well-meaning influencer who may say the wrong thing. But and I guess I have some sympathy because the media gets it wrong sometimes as well, right? And
then we all do. Yeah. The older I get, the more I realize I'm a hypocrite. But I think it's sometimes a novice question is actually the most enlightening question in the world.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And if you can't explain it to a fifth grader or whatever, can you, you know, stand behind it and does it stand up? That's kind of... Yeah.
That's right. And you know, traditionally the industry has inoculated itself from this. It's not used to having to answer these sorts of questions. I mean, it's used to answering them from people like me at press conferences, right? But it's not used to having to deal with them on Instagram or on TikTok. And I think that that's overwhelmingly a positive sort of development. But, you know, as with anything else, you have to really scrutinize any of the information that you're receiving. I think the other thing that ASIC is maybe concerned about, and I think they're could be some grounds for this is some of these well-meaning influencers could easily, I think, fall prey to a business model or a, you know, a sort of fee model that might not be in the interests of people watching or that could be conflicted. And we've seen this in the past, right, Glenn, where I'm sure a lot of your former colleagues in the financial planning industry are perfectly good, decent employees, family people, and then they got caught up in a system where there were these kind of conflicted incentives and they kind of, you know, got sucked into it by their employer or by others. And that's how it often does occur, this kind of misconduct. So I do think, you know, there are sharks who are going to be out there trying to look at how they can kind of monetize and get a piece of this sort of finfluencer action. And so, you know, the ones who are creating this content need to be aware of that. And just like you were outlining with your podcast, be super selective who they do deals with, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I talked to one finfluencer once and they said their whole purpose for the online account is to make money. And I encourage that individual that I think you need – that's not going to have longevity. You need to go back to you want to educate and help people.
Yeah, and look, making money is not going to be difficult to do if they don't apply an ethical filter at all, right? You know, maybe the dark web would be a good place for them. There's all sorts of money to be made. Not that I'm endorsing that.
But just you know, on this, so the licensing requirement, I've started to say publicly now that I think if you do have significant influence, and I've just thought 10,000 followers on an online account, because after 10,000 followers on Instagram, as it stands at the moment, you can have a link on your story, all right? So I think if you've got over 10,000 followers and you are monetizing the account, you're actually not doing it for fun at that point. You've got 10,000 followers, you've got affiliate links, you've got all that. all that's fine. I just think if you've got that many people following you and you're making money, there needs to be some type of bar or threshold that needs to have some type of, I won't say license, but, you know, the current framework that ASIC have just doesn't fit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the very least, they need to go back and review the guidance.
That's right.
But I don't think a licensing regime is right. We have enough of those, and they inevitably cause all sorts of problems. You know, what has happened in the financial planning world for actual advisors is that the owners of those licenses have come to, you know, over the last 20 years, control a lot of that advice, and a lot of it hasn't been in the best interests of consumers, right? So, I mean, I don't think having a license is necessary. The answer to good quality information. But I do think that influencers need to abide by the law as it stands, and that means that they can't recommend financial products.
But the problem,
and they shouldn't go near that.
Yeah, but the problem, Alex, is as the law currently stands, as soon as you open your trap and talk about a product, a class of products, or whatever, whether you're at the pub talking to your mate or whether you've got an Instagram account with 20,000 people following you, the moment you say the word superannuation or investing or in shares, you're over the threshold of financial product advice. So the question isn't, are they giving advice? As far as ASIC are concerned, the guy at the pub is giving advice all day long. The person online is giving advice all day long. The question is, under the current regime, should they be licensed? Now, we know the guy at the pub shouldn't be licensed. That's right. And there is a media exemption. So, for example,
I'm talking on it right now.
Exactly. And, you know, the Today Show, Ross Greenwood, he's not there anymore, but whoever it is now, we'll talk about shares for 10 minutes. But the main
Chris Kohler.
Yeah, hey,
like
Chris.
My own organization.
I've got to get Chris on the podcast. I want to get him and his dad.
He's a lovely, lovely
I know. Man. I know him. We know him from, well, I
Don't
met him.
Don't worry about his dad. Alan Kohler's old news. Chris Kohler's the future.
I want to get them both on. Maybe we'll get you and Chris on. But, you know, the core business of the Today Show isn't to do affiliate marketing for an investment platform. So there's an exemption.
That's
why my gut feeling at the moment is if you're an influencer and you are making money, well, what's your core business for that account?
Yeah, yeah. And I do think that's probably the way that ASIC is thinking about it as well, which is why they keep bringing their limited comments in public so far back to the idea of a business carrying on, you know, kind of the commercial operations of financial advice.
Yes.
So for them, they're not worried about the bloke in the pub because he's not being monetized for that. And so, you know, that's probably a good way to think about it. But I think broadly there's, I think there's been a little bit too much dismissal of what a lot of these influencers are trying to achieve. And as much as I'm a big advocate for professional financial advice, Glenn, and have been throughout my career, I generally think there's a benefit to getting that over getting it elsewhere, if nothing else, because of the legal recourse that you've got if something goes wrong. And that's where a licensing regime is helpful.
That's right.
But having said that, I don't buy this idea that we've seen in news.com.au and elsewhere in the last few weeks where these influencers have been kind of really disparaged because there's this line that unless you're licensed, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, you know, firstly, that really, I think, doesn't do justice to the Royal Commission process that we had, that a lot of journalists who worked a lot longer than me over many decades have fought hard to sort of get off the ground, and the whistleblowers and, you know, people who sort of put their hand up to expose that misconduct and make that inquiry happen. I don't think it's sort of does any kind of justice to have this view proliferated out there that people who've been licensed have never committed any harms. And I also think, you know, when you look at the education thing, yes, it's true that they're introducing reforms to force financial planners to upskill, but the majority, as it stands, don't have university degrees. Now, I'm not a big believer that a university degree is the be all and end all, and that, you know, we need to have education is the only thing that people should be looking at, because of course, you know, Bernie Madoff had all sorts of degrees. But I do think that, you know, there's this kind of knee-jerk view from the industry that, you know, these influencers are dangerous idiots who are unqualified, and it's just simply not true. There are all sorts of people who are out there engaging in their finances, and many of them are very accomplished in their personal lives and have got all sorts of, you know, qualifications. So, yeah, I think it's a bit overdone.
And I would probably say, number one, first and foremost, get your own, like, don't even listen to Glenn James. There's so much crap that I say that's probably not right. I just want to head up this community and be the leader. Whereas, you know, we did an accounting, I did some accounting Q&As on Instagram the other day. And it was a prime example. I've got no idea about tax. So go to an accountant. And yeah. I think the yeah. whole thing, you know, I think Superhero did that report that you may have mentioned that there's actually bugger all people getting advice from Instagram. Like realistically. Yeah, well, and if you really want to look at it in terms of a financial risk, if I open an online account that some influencer reviewed, and then I invest $2,000 into it, right? Provided it's not freaking Cryptcoin or it's just a Vanguard fund or whatever,
yeah.
There's not a huge material risk to someone's life. Like, we're not talking about, you know, the storm financial thing where we're giving loans to, 58-year-olds who, you know, are about to retire and they're getting double geared into this thing. Like, it's pretty innocent. And
a lot of it is. And look, my general view is, and I'm a bit of a free speech guy, I do think there should be rules around this. I do think some of it's potentially dangerous. But at the end of the day, I think people need to consider it what it is, which is free online information with no barriers to entry, which is effectively crowdsourced or peer-to-peer, right? And I think we are very much moving to a world where people are willing to pay for content, and we saw that. It's taken a long time since the internet came about for that culture to change, but we saw in that Superhero research that even a large number of millennial investors are engaging with online news that has paywalls, with print newspapers that have a barrier to entry. So of course, as someone representing the AFR, which I think is the world's most expensive newspaper, I'm going to have a bias towards a user pays model. But frankly, I see the benefits of that every day, because an article that I write, while, you know, occasionally, of course, I'll get it wrong just like anybody else, but there's, you know, four or five very qualified human beings who see my work before it becomes public, right? So it's the absolute opposite end of the spectrum to a live stream on TikTok. The people, you know, there's multiple human beings, there's fact checking, there's sub editing, and that's expensive, right?
Yeah. And even the, so we did an Instagram post the other day called "It's Tax Time, Baby," or something like that. And I put tax tips. Even the thing that I wrote in one of the tips was slightly incorrect. Like, there was one thing that was in brackets or whatever that was miscorrect, I had to put a correction in the comments. So no one's above this. So if you're going to really have a whinge about something online, it's free, lower your standards and move on.
Yeah, I think, and be willing to pay for research, not just, newspapers, but be willing to pay for bespoke research, for professional advice, and for things that, you know, you can trust. But that doesn't mean you should disengage or be nervous about following a bunch of influencers who have great content. And I think those influencers need to be aware that the regulator is watching them and should be. That doesn't mean that they should stop doing what they're doing, but it means that they should maybe be sure of where the line in the sand is, and make sure that they're not crossing it to the best of their ability, right?
Yeah. And we might finish up, because we're going to start to sound like a couple of old guys having a bit of a rant.
I'm a millennial. I don't know about you.
I'm a millennial.
I just scrape in.
Yeah, I'm a millennial.
I thought you were just using the branding.
No. I'm official. But everyone, like, if you
we're
are...
We're cusp at best, Glenn.
No, I'm well and truly millennial. You back off. For any Finfluencers listening, I'll put a link in the show note. I'm actually going to do a live webinar with Vince Scully, and we just want to kind of get some Finfluencers together, and you'll need to apply. You know, if you've got an account with 100 people and you haven't posted in a, you know, 5 weeks, we might not, you know, admit you. But for any active quote-unquote Finfluencers, we're just going to have a webinar, and it's going to be closed to the general public. Like, you must have a Finfluencer account. And we're just going to open the floor, and just if you want to ask some questions about investing in a safe place, we just want to start to educate you. And you know, I'm really like keen to kind of help this part of the ecosystem. And you know, I want to get Jane Hume on, but she probably won't come on. But I want to really talk about this stuff and see how we can get the legislation in line with the technology, because it's the same story. You know, Uber faced it, Airbnb faced it, Tesla faced it. Like, all this 21st century stuff with 20th century legislation, it's an issue.
Well, I'm sure all the content creators out there just want some clarity on all this, right? And they're not going to get it from this government because, you know, we've been asking this question for over a year now, not just what do they think about Finfluencers, but what do they think about this broader kind of Robinhood trend of self-directed retail investors in the markets? And they haven't had an answer, and then finally did come up with an answer, and their answer was, you know, let the market run. So, you know, I think probably they've been distracted in the super wars and
yeah.
haven't had the time to come up with a cogent policy to try and deal with some of these.
But honestly, so like,
it's going to fall to you, Mr. James.
Well, I'll give it a shake, because, like, honestly, I want everybody, no matter if you're an employee at a job, whether you're self-employed, you're a builder or a plumber or a marketing assistant or a hairdresser, or you're an online Finfluence, whatever, I want everyone to be able to make a living guilt-free and do bloody well. You know, I hope there's an influencer out there that's legitimate and he's printing money.
Yeah, and be willing to correct yourself when you're wrong, right?
Absolutely. And I'm not above any of this. You know, I've taken the view that I want to get out of the grey and pay for a license. If there was another type of license or something that wasn't, you know, $40,000 a year, I'd definitely consider that. But, you know, it's just, it's a real thing and I'm not above any of this.
Well, neither, but having said that, not looking forward to there being a license regime for journalists anytime soon, or a regulator for that matter.
Yeah, well,
that would be a step too far.
Totally. So, all right, we might leave it there. You can subscribe to the Wealth Generation newsletter. There's a link in the show notes, and we will we'll look forward to our next chat, Alex.
Thanks, mate. See you next time.
All right, bye.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
My Millennial Money supports A21, a charity focused on abolishing slavery and human trafficking all over the world. Check out a21.org.au for more info. If you would like some other giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to thelifeyoucansave.org.au.
This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, is an authorised representative of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.